the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast for two siblings who love books.
We love books so much that we cloned all of our books.
Yep, that way in case one of my books tears a page, I can just replace it.
Yeah, this book I have right here that Atticus decided to chew on.
Yeah, that looks a little dog worn.
It's about to get replaced with its clone.
He's just a puppy. He doesn't know how to read. He thinks chewing the pages will transmit the words to his brain.
That's the first book he's ever chewed. Like, I keep books on the floor all the time. That's the first one. And thank God I own that one. So I'm actually not that upset.
Yeah.
If it was a library book or something someone lent me, I'd be much more distraught.
Looks like it's mostly the cover anyway.
Yeah. I was like, whatever. It's not like Vinny chewing, like, the Oxford edition of a Shakespeare play that one of Dad's friends lent me, and it was, like, her dad's old set, and they were, like, really nice bound copies, and Vinny chewed the cover off of it, and I was like, oh, God.
So embarrassing.
It was awful. I was mortified. Yep, there goes me being a responsible person.
Dogs also love books, but not the same way we do.
Subtitle.
That's right.
So this week we read Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ichiguro. It's my best guess at how to pronounce his name.
It's pretty close to my best guess.
I guess I'll go ahead and throw out a spoiler warning about the book. I think it's... Before I read it, basically the only thing I knew about it was, I guess, what you would consider the spoiler. I'm going to throw it out there anyway, just in case someone wants to read this book unspoiled.
Sure.
Because it's kind of impossible to talk about without spoiling it. So go ahead and turn off the podcast now if you don't want to be spoiled. And if you don't care, the focus of the book is the main characters are all actually clones. And they, when they grow up, their body parts and organs are going to be harvested to fix the diseases of other people in society.
Yes. And additionally, lest you think this is one of those books where when they are old enough to realize the full ramifications of that, they run off and escape that society, they do not.
Yeah, it's not that kind of book.
No.
It's not the sort of thing where you, like, have the horror realization and there's, like, all the minorities protesting against cloning and they, like...
No, this is not Logan's Run.
No. It's actually, like, surprisingly just matter-of-fact and very straightforward. Like, they just kind of accept their fate and walk into it.
Maybe that's part of the power of it, because it is a book that comes recommended frequently, mm-hmm. which is one of the main reasons we're reading it, I'm pretty sure.
A reader recommendation, and I just saw a bunch of recommendations for it in general.
Yeah. And it's a title that... when I've been mentioning it to people, I haven't actually come across someone who's read it yet. People say, oh, what are you reading? I'm reading Never Let Me Go. And they'll be like, where have I heard that before? And it's like, well, there was a large-ish studio release of a movie of the same name a few years ago that got slightly above average reviews. And I think that's about all I can say about it.
Yeah, Goodreads posted the activity on my Facebook wall and someone said, oh, have you seen the movie?
Yeah.
That's the only response I've gotten towards it. I said, nope. No, I remember reading a little bit about it, but...
Wasn't that one of those that came out, like, occasionally you'll get two movies that are kind of similar, at least in premise. Like, that was out at the same time as some other movie that was kind of like that, maybe.
Oh, I have no idea.
Or maybe it was out at the same time as The Island and they have nothing to do with each other or something like that. I don't know.
They just involve clones.
Right.
Yeah, I don't actually know. I just think...
Like the Deep Impact Armageddon pair.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know what you're talking about. But it might have just been that people were like, oh, yeah, that book... whatever.
Yeah.
Because it didn't get a ton of recognition, but some people have seen it, obviously. So, the genre, we kind of picked it as a science fiction read because it gets kind of tossed into the science fiction category. But it's kind of like The Handmaid's Tale, where, yeah, I guess it's speculative fiction and there's some science-y things going on, but it's really not about that.
Yeah, well, speculative fiction seems to be what you call science fiction when you're trying not to scare away non-science fiction fans. Like, well, it has a premise that's science fiction-y, but it doesn't have all that nerdy science fiction stuff in it. It's about feelings instead. And it's like, oh, okay, well, I guess I can read it. and this definitely is that type of book.
Well, speculative fiction also is slightly more present today.
Right, it tends to be, oh, well, it's 5 years from now and we made some discovery, you know, tomorrow that affects what this new society is like, or we made some law that affects what this is now like, as opposed to Hyperion, where it's probably like 4,000 years in the future and has nothing to do with anything we can currently relate to.
Yeah. Right. So, speculative fiction.
Right.
This is actually, the book takes place in the 1990s, or I guess them being at Hailsham is the 1990s.
The distant future, 1999.
So, the year 2000. The distant future.
Or the old NES games, that would be like, the year 19XX. Terrifyingly far in the future.
What?
What?
Yeah, so, plot synopsis.
If you're from Hailsham, you're lucky, but you'll still be dead by 30.
Yeah, basically. That's one of the running threads throughout this book, is the main character, Kathy, grew up in this, what essentially seemed like just a boarding school.
Yeah.
At this place called Hailsham. She talks a lot about her friends there and all their various nuanced relationships. And then she finds out as an adult, when she becomes a carer for other clones, that a lot of clones grow up in really shady situations, or like where they're not treated very well. And so Hailsham is kind of like the gold standard, and they're really lucky for getting to go there. But then you find out that, well, I mean, I guess their childhoods weren't traumatic, but they're still, like, getting their organs harvested with no hope of living a normal life.
Right. One of the many questions I have about this world is what exactly those conditions are like for people who didn't go to a Hailsham sort of setup.
Mm-hmm.
Was it, like, were they educated at all?
Yeah, like, some of it sounds kind of like in the early days of the cloning that they talk about, that it was more like, clones were a little more like cattle almost. Like, you were just kind of raised in, like, shitty situations where, like, everyone's, like, packed together and they don't really pay attention to you and they don't really, like, feed or clothe you, and then you hit a certain age and they just harvest your organs. So Hailsham's, like, an attempt to be more civilized.
Right. Well, there are a lot of ethics and implications behind all of that.
Is Never Letting Go really a criticism of the meat industry? Do cows have souls?
I don't know. Maybe we'll start sending them to boarding schools.
I feel like that's something you could, like, parody with vegans or something.
Right.
Anyway, so yeah. But Ben and I are talking about, like, the reason it's speculative fiction. So the science fiction kind of premise is that medicine was able to develop this cloning technology where you can create a person, and when they grow up, then you can harvest their organs and basically cure any disease, which, well, I guess we don't know if we could do that in modern day or not, because we don't raise people to harvest their organs,
right.
Typically. But that's something that doesn't happen in today's world, so that's kind of the science fiction premise. But then, it serves as a backdrop for the story, but the main focus of the story is really Kathy and her relationships with her friends. And the clone stuff is a very minority part of it.
Yeah, it's something that's always there that they always wonder about, but the plot, as such, is not related to it almost at all.
Yeah. It just kind of comes up in bits and pieces and then dismissed. And it's not until the end that you really get, like, an info dump of stuff about clones. So, that's kind of the different-y approach to it. Like we said, it's basically set in the 1990s. in England. All the characters are very British, yes. Which we'll talk about. and it is told from Kathy's point of view, so she's talking in the first person, mainly reminiscing about the past from this kind of tipping point in her own life where she realizes that she will soon, or at the end of the year, she will no longer be a carer, so someone taking care of clones who are making organ donations, and she will soon go in for her first donation and become a donor herself.
Yes. Which she accepts with equanimity, I would say.
Yeah.
Especially having been doing the carer gig for 11 years,
mm-hmm.
and having seen a lot of it, and I don't know, maybe she accepts fate to the degree where she doesn't, literally does not worry about it ever.
Yeah. She's like, well, that's, can't escape it.
Right.
All my friends are dead, so.
Yeah, right.
Moving on.
Where do I have to go?
She's very unusual for having been a carer for so many years, and I think they said she's like 30 or 31, so she's actually like.
She's old.
Especially long lived
for a clone, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, Kathy, is a person who seems to be, a little more observant than average. She has, you know, I kind of described her as having this kind of odd, detached compassion when we were talking earlier.
I would definitely agree with that.
Because she's good at this carer gig, she seems to understand what other people are thinking and feeling more readily than most people can, but at the same time, like, she seems to have just a little bit of distance from things.
She doesn't get, like, as shaken up and upset at things as a lot of other, like, other characters will be really upset, or it's a situation where you, like, would expect her to cry, and she'll say, like, oh, you know, I was shaking, or I cried, but just for a little bit, and then I mostly calmed down in the next, you know, like, while I was driving, and I was fine by the time I got there, or whatever. And I was like, holy crap, like, she does a good job of putting a lid on it, I guess. Or she just, like, is really good at coming to terms with things quickly, and so doesn't stay upset for long.
Yeah, or, I mean, even her relationship with Tommy, which I suppose you could paint as a, like, great love story or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I would go that far, personally.
It definitely could have gone in that direction.
Yes. I was going to say, she was looking at him, especially when they were younger, like, more out of curiosity than anything else. She wasn't like, oh, his feelings are so important to me. She was more just like, You're strange, and you don't seem to know that you're strange. Like, here's how you could fit in better. And he kind of goes, oh, you think so?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. Oh, well, maybe I'll try that.
Yeah, or like she says, you know, I'm kind of willing to talk to this guy and figure him out. And then they just kind of become friends by virtue of being willing to talk to each other.
Yeah.
And they seem to, like, really understand each other and get along. But it's, yeah, never really painted in the light of, like, them pining for each other.
No, they don't seem star-crossed or anything like that.
Yeah, they don't, like, strike up a relationship and they're so madly, passionately in love, and at the end of the book, they're torn apart by fate and circumstance.
Right.
Like, that's kind of what happens, but, like, in a very muted way.
Yeah, that'd be a decent synopsis or description of the book, too. Like a tragedy involving star-crossed lovers in a muted way.
In a British way.
In a British way, yeah. I was also joking when we were talking earlier that the secret protagonist is the stiff upper lip. Because there are moments where I guess part of it is that it's never really a total surprise. Even as young students, they knew what they were. They just didn't really talk about it or bring it up all that often. But there are moments that really seem like they should be giant body blows to one's sense of self and maybe even will to live. And they're just kind of like, Right, so, tea.
Alright then.
I said, the only way you could make this thing more British would be to have, like, bombs going off in the background during the Blitz or something.
And there's like, right?
Oh, they're going to harvest some body parts. Yes, quite. Shall we find a shelter? Indeed.
And that's kind of one of the things that's, I guess, interesting about Kathy's quality is, like, not only does she remember all this stuff from her childhood, but she remembers some of the details, like, with so much clarity, and these tiny details can become, like, enormous moments, but then they're, like, weirdly understated enormous moments. So, like, one of the things I brought up, we were outlining, was Ruth, who's Kathy's friend. She has this pencil case that's, like, really great, and she implies that one of the guardians, one of the teachers, essentially, the school gave it to her, which would be, like, a huge deal. And then Kathy's all pissed off because she's like, oh, whatever. Like, she didn't actually get that.
Yeah, Ruth's doing her full of shit thing again.
Yeah, so she goes and, like, finds out that Ruth bought it at this, like, monthly sale they have at the school. And instead of, like, taking, you know, the register and, like, outing Ruth in front of everyone and being like, oh, I found out that you're a phony. Like, she and Ruth are like, at a bus stop because it's raining, so they're hiding from the rain. And then Kathy just casually says, oh, I was looking through a sales register. I don't even know if she says, like, I found your pencil case on it. I think she's
just, I think she just said she's looking through a sales register for the event.
Yeah, and then Ruth stiffens because she knows exactly what Kathy's getting at. And then Kathy's like, I, you know, immediately knew I made this huge mistake. They don't talk about any further. They, like, never make a reference to it again. And then Kathy's, like, spending the next 3 weeks looking for any opportunity she has to, like, make it up to Ruth by doing something nice for her. But it's, like, this huge, like, watershed moment in their friendship where, like, this whole, like, horrible thing, like, Kathy calls her out. But then it's just, like, so let's look into the sales register. And Ruth's like, oh. And then Kathy's like, oh, shit. And then, like, that's the whole thing. Like, that's their conversation.
The book definitely has a British feel to it in the way that some of the classics that you have to read in school do. Some of the things that people would have, like the Jane Austen novel, things that a lot of my classmates, and I'm sure a lot of yours too, would have complained about. Well, nothing happens. They have this conversation and this guy goes away and doesn't come back for a long time because he's so deeply offended over something that I'm 17 and I don't even understand. And that is, this book feels a lot like that. Like the really subtle interplay on things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it works kind of the same way where you feel a lot of the underlying tension, even though no one's ever having like a big soap opera shouting dramatic sort of moment.
Yeah, there are like a couple of big fights, but overall it's very just calm.
Yeah.
It's all happening under the surface. Or even the moments like where the teachers reference things, it's usually just like a sentence.
Right, and most of the students don't even catch it, or they more, I guess they hear it and are kind of like, well, that's an odd thing to say.
Like, someone asks, so the apparently, like, at the school, they keep getting it pounded in them that smoking is, like, just the most horrible thing you could possibly do, and so all of them are, like, staunchly anti-smoking, and one day someone asks one of the guardians if she's ever smoked, and everyone's like, it's so scandalous.
Right.
And the guardian says, yes, like, I did for a little while, and then she kind of says, but it's much more important for you not to smoke.
Yeah.
And then everyone's kind of like, huh? And then they, like, move on.
Right. The subtext, of course, being, because those aren't actually your lungs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, if you smoke and damage your body, you're hurting other people that are supposed to be getting your parts.
Because then some person who does smoke and has lung cancer can't get your nice, healthy lungs.
Now, don't you see how that works?
But you can't go right out and say that. Or at least it's not school policy to go right out and say that.
Yeah. And Kathy seems to really, like, notice those moments and hold on to them. And she and Tommy even talk about some of them, because Tommy is also a character who seems to realize those things. But a lot of the other kids don't seem to.
Yeah, Tommy and Kathy are both people who don't have very many close friends, I think.
Yeah.
Kathy makes so many references to other people that it sounds like she gets along just fine with almost everybody, but big people she'll actually spend a lot of time with, or have, like, a deep conversation with, at least, are Ruth and Tommy.
Yeah.
And then there are people she hangs out with, like she mentions Laura, who's kind of the clown when they're younger, and then runs across her once as an adult, and it's kind of a... It's a moment because it's a non-moment, right? And like, well, you know, she pissed and moaned for 20 minutes, and then we awkwardly parted and never saw each other again.
Yeah.
I guess I'm gonna talk about her friends a little bit.
Okay.
Since we were kind of starting down that path a moment ago, because Tommy is definitely kind of like that himself, I think, where most people just don't really quite connect with him. He doesn't necessarily get along with everybody, I think, but I think as he gets older, it's more of a just maybe not as interested in each other as opposed to when he's a kid and they used to bully him.
Yeah, he also kind of has some underlying anger issues.
Yes.
That he does better at suppressing when he gets older.
Yes.
Kind of throwing a tantrum, basically, when people are a jerk to him.
Right, like, he was doing that way past the age where it's acceptable.
Yeah.
He'd be, like, 10 or 12 and freaking out because something relatively minor happened. And that was, I mean, it's part of the reason the kids would torment him, because he would give such a satisfying reaction.
Yeah.
Which, you know, people are wired that way, for sure.
Well, and what was it? The whole, like, incident that set off people bullying him in the first place was, like, one day in class he painted an elephant.
Yeah.
To try and be funny. I don't really get how that's funny. And
I think it was just that it was a childish thing to do for that age.
Yeah.
And I guess no one really got the joke.
And then the teacher, like, was like, oh, it's wonderful, Tommy.
Right.
And everyone was like, oh, like...
She was all patronizing.
Yeah, so everyone started making fun of him.
What was that? It's that classic school moment when you're past the age where a teacher talking to you that way works. Because you're too old for it. And for some kids that happens when they're like 10 or 12 or something. For some it happens when they're like 7. But that, oh, you know, that's great. What a wonderful elephant you made. And unfortunately everyone in the room was past that age. And
it was like, oh, Tommy's an idiot.
Yeah, it became a thing. Like, oh, the teacher was just openly acknowledging that you're a dumb shit. So now it's okay for all of us to pick on you.
Yeah.
Because you're the weak one.
Yeah. Whereas if she had been like, Tommy, stop being so childish, then everyone would have just been like, oh, whatever.
Well, hell, it might have gone over well. If like, she'd had a total meltdown, it might have gone the completely opposite direction. What are you doing painting this elephant in the grass? What are you, 8 years old? And he's like, Everyone's like, easy out, Tommy. Totally gave like a fuck you to the teacher in class today.
That was awesome.
That guy's cool.
But again, it gets funny to me, the just kind of the tone of this novel, how like everything branches out of like all these moments that are just so small.
That's true.
Like, I painted an elephant in the grass, and then I was bullied nonstop for, like, 4 years at school. Or, like, I mentioned a sales register to my best friend, and she and I, like, didn't get along for 2 months.
I know. Compare those events to, I mean, and this isn't a YA novel. The part one, I guess, could arguably kind of sort of be.
Yeah.
But I imagine a YA novel and what it would take for someone to get bullied steadily for 4 years. I mean, given modern YA trends, it would probably turn out they got raped in a closet or something.
Yeah.
Because they'd be trying to hit that issue because they feel like they have to.
Yeah.
But it would never be something that subtle for sure. Like, oh, well, there was the time I would pooped my pants in class and now everyone's mean to me for no reason and it's totally unfair. Or because I'm the poor kid in the rich class. It would almost have to be an issue and not an elephant on a canvas.
Not like a really random, like, one day at lunch I got a pizza instead of a sandwich and then everyone started calling me Pizza Boy. Yeah. And like, what the fuck? Something like that.
And that became Zaboy and that became Z and now I'm always at the end. There, I just wrote a YA novel.
Okay.
Too plausible.
I'm too amused.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so, Tommy.
Right, Tommy.
So, yeah, once he kind of gets over his anger issues and stops giving them this reaction that they want, he stops becoming a point of derision, but from the other kids.
And... Right. And he does develop quite a bit of depth, because as he gets older, again, he's the only other student who seems to be kind of perceptive.
Yeah, and he wonders a lot about, like, when they're talking about the gallery, for instance, Madame, who's this person who shows up at their school and, like, takes the best of their creative works, and there's this big rumor that she has this big gallery, and, like, no one really knows why, and are all kind of talking about it, but not talking about it, and Tommy, like, sits there and ponders that after they leave, and then decides, like, okay, like, this is what it's for, and I didn't have any art in it, so he, like, starts this concerted effort to, like, try and make these great drawings so that he can, like, you know, prove himself, and that's something that I don't think, like, a lot of the other characters would worry about.
Right. Well, and apparently these drawings, this guy who basically never had showed any artistic talent, once he starts focusing real energy on it, they sound like they're pretty cool.
They do sound like they're cool.
These little animals with all these intricate, like, kind of vaguely steampunky details.
Yeah.
I wonder if the movie has some concept art that someone whipped up.
Yeah, some of his drawings.
If you see some of that in there.
So Tommy and Kathy work together really well as friends, because they're both just really thoughtful. They're both a little odd. And they work as two of the main characters because they ask a lot of those questions that, like, normal students might not ask. So then you get a little bit more from it than you would following somebody else.
And they seem to have a connection that, like, it seems logical that they should become the ones who are lovers way before the very end when it happens for a little while.
Yeah.
Not in, like, the painful, I ship this so hard kind of way that some books do, but in the way where it's more like, well, this seems like a logical progression, so when it doesn't happen, it kind of bothers me on that level.
Yeah, I was, like, just weirded out by it. I was like, why is he not with Kathy? Like,
right.
I don't get this.
It'd be one of those things where if a stranger met Tommy and Ruth and Kathy walking down the street, and then, you know, like, Ruth and Tommy are shoulder to shoulder or something because they're the couple, and he watches, like, has a brief conversation with them interacting, and he'd walk away and be like, so those two were leaning on each other, but those two are totally the ones fucking each other, right?
Yeah, like, are they like brother and sister? Right. Like, what's going on here?
There's a thing going on here that I don't understand.
Yeah, and I actually, like, through, I guess we can talk about Ruth, who's kind of the third person in this group. She's a lot different from Kathy and Tommy. She's kind of one of those prototypical mean girls. She always wants to be the center of attention. She wants to be the leader of the group, and she loves drama. So, like, she's a sort of person who's like, okay, here's the game we're playing, here's all the rules, I'm in charge, and then if someone, like, tries to make their own rule or steps out of bounds or anything, then she's like, you're out of the group. She's like one of those people. And yeah. I knew a couple of people in elementary school, and I was not friends with them. And Kathy, it surprised me that she and Kathy were such good friends, because I would think at some point Kathy would just be like, fuck you, and, like, go hang out with other people.
I know, I kept waiting for it to happen.
And that was the other thing that surprised me about Kathy and Tommy not being together, is we know that Ruth and Tommy are together, which didn't really make any sense. And then we see, like, three or four scenes of Ruth being, like, really nasty to Tommy.
It's, like, cutting him down, but in ways that, ways that would humiliate someone at their core.
Yeah.
not in, like, a, oh, don't, you know, ignore him right now. Not in, like, the kind of way where someone gets pissy because they're not getting enough attention for the night, but in the way like, oh, remember these animals that he makes to show us his soul? Aren't those ridiculous?
Yeah.
Like, everyone who's seen those thinks they're ridiculous. Aren't I right? And Kathy's like, I'm on the spot. Don't know what to do.
Yeah. Or like, oh, don't listen to Tommy. He's an it. Like, back in school, everyone thought he was an idiot.
Right.
Instead of just like, Tommy, can you please shut up for a second? I mean, that'd be mean, but, like, she's nasty.
Right.
And I kept expecting Tommy to be like, Ruth, fuck you. And then, like, get with Kathy. And, like, it was kind of... The main reason it was bothering me was not because I wanted Tommy and Kathy to be together, but because Ruth was pissing me off so bad.
I know. I did not like her whatsoever.
I did not like her at all.
She was bringing the drama llama, and not in a fun way.
Yeah. She was, like, all of the center of, like, all of the drama that happens in the book.
Yes. She was the only one who created real drama. I guess I would like to say, when you initially meet her as a kid, you're thinking, oh, well, maybe she'll be kind of fun and a little bit complicated as things go along, because before you realized how overbearing she was, she did seem like the strong-willed, really creative kid.
Yeah.
Like, oh, hey, would you like to come ride my horses? And it was a little kid game.
And she has, like, a name and personality for all of her horses. Right. Like, that's pretty cute.
Pretty clever.
Yeah.
Or even just on the face of it, like the special protectors or guardians, whatever they're called, with the one teacher she basically had a little bit of a kid crush on. And they, like, had their secret society and they knew there were spies and new stuff was going on. It sounds like a really cute little kid game that would definitely happen.
Yeah,
but it was that extra level of, well, some people would cross her and then they'd be out forever.
Right.
They'd become part of the conspiracy.
Yeah, it was kind of reminding me of elementary school. Me and my friends had this whole theory that aliens were infiltrating the school and they were going to blow it up on the last day of school and we were trying to stop it from happening. It totally reminded me of that, but then Ruth, like, took it the extra level where if you were like, oh, well, we just know this is a silly game, she'd be like, ouch.
Well, that'd totally be a fun game, too, as a kid. It's like, well, we're their bodyguards. They don't know that we are. There's a conspiracy. We know it's everywhere. But the person we're protecting doesn't know about it. Like, you could do all sorts of silly, ridiculous stuff, like, on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
And people would occasionally look at you kind of weird, and then you just run off giggling like kids do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but Ruth was always...
Right, it was a ruthless measure of social control, so to speak.
Yeah, and actually, it's interesting that one moment where she kicked a girl out of the group and is doing something, Ruth is doing something kind of stupid, and that girl says something to Kathy like, oh man, that's such a ridiculous game. And Kathy had just been, like, scorned by Ruth, and she could totally be like, oh yeah, it totally is. And, like, she and that girl could have become, like, best friends.
Right.
And instead she's like, don't talk about Ruth like that! No!
Well, and again, in the modern YA novel, it would have been the moment of forming the new faction, for sure, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah, totally. Yeah. So, but that was kind of where Ben and I ran into our roadblock, is I think both of us really dislike Ruth and just think she's not a great person. And then we don't really get why, like, Kathy, who's, you know, kind of quiet observer, not a drama attractor, would be such good friends with someone who causes so much strife in her life. And then at the end of the book, Ruth says, oh yeah, I straight up knew I was keeping you and Tommy apart, and I basically just did it out of spite because I was jealous. And it's like, oh my god! Ruth, Jesus!
Oh, turns out you are just as petty and horrible as we thought.
Yeah. I mean, at least she, like, realizes it and apologizes, I guess, before she dies, but...
I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. There are a lot of other student characters, but they're mostly mentioned in passing, so we're gonna ignore all of the rest of them.
I think that's wise, actually.
And just talk about a couple of the teachers that we run into who kind of give us a fuller idea of the society and flesh things out a little bit. So we have Miss Emily, who was like the head guardian at the school or camp or whatever the hell English was.
Right.
So she was kind of the principal, I guess. She taught some classes, but she was the one who, like, the students all went to for, like, discipline and stuff like that.
Right. And she was pretty tough and had definitely had, like, an unusual air of authority about her. And then at the end of the book, we meet her again, and she's actually one of the key figures in this movement to mm-hmm. set up a place like Hailsham in the first place. And has a pretty interesting view on things, I guess, because on one hand, she thinks that these clones are probably people, but on the other hand, like, has some revulsion towards them, and then was trying to help them and trying to, a little bit, well, kind of, trying to give them a better existence without ending their fate.
Yeah, so, like, the whole purpose of Hailsham and the art, which is, like, such a huge deal at the beginning,
yeah,
is you show, like, all these donors the clones' best art and poetry to try and convince them, oh, look, clones have souls, too, so we should treat them well. But it doesn't sound like it's we should treat them well and therefore stop the process of harvesting their organs when they hit a certain age, but more just, like, treat them good in childhood, but then you can totally still harvest their organs when they hit a certain age.
Yes.
And so Hailsham was kind of an experiment in that.
Yeah, and she doesn't seem to want to do anything to help these former students when they're face-to-face years later, either.
Yeah, she says she feels sorry for them. I think she calls them, like, poor dears or something.
Yeah.
But, yeah, she's like, oh, I'm afraid there's nothing I can do. Not in the way of, like, raging against the machine. Like, I literally, like, if I tried to help you, the secret police would, like, come burn down my house and murder my entire family.
Right.
Like, there's nothing I can do for you. Kind of thing.
Right.
But I'll go ahead and tell you everything, because you're here. And you're gonna help die soon, so whatever.
Yeah, right. It doesn't even matter.
And one of the things that occurred to me is she's in a wheelchair, and she says something to them about, like, oh, I don't really expect to be in this for the rest of my life. And I was like, oh my god, is, like, she up for, like, an organ donation
sure
to, like,
she
get
is.
Her out of the chair? And then she's, like, a total hypocrite.
We're gonna get you a new femur and a new spinal cord and and get you on your feet again, or whatever's wrong with you.
Yeah.
I don't know what their limit of their ability to transplant things is, but
yeah.
It seems like they can harvest quite a few things while you're still alive, based on what we know.
Yeah. So, yeah, but Miss Emily's kind of was the face of this movement to treat clones more humanely.
Yeah.
And Hailsham was kind of like the great experiment in that, and everything seemed to be going well for a while, but then people decided to shut it down.
Yeah, the thing that she kind of reminded me of is one of those books where there's a good slave owner, so to speak.
Quote unquote.
Right, exactly. Someone who's saying, well, everybody should treat their slaves better, but isn't quite going as far as to say, oh, and that means we should definitely release them, because, you know, making someone a slave is treating them pretty badly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess I won't reference 12 Years a Slave.
No.
There's totally, like, the good slave owner in that movie who's, like, really nice and treats his slaves well. But then, like, when shit goes down, he's still like, oh, I don't know, I can't do anything, you're my slave.
Right.
Whatever. And you're like, well, you're not really better than the bad slave owner who beats his slaves. Like, you're both shitty because you're both slave owners. Yeah, and I mean, you could view the clones as a type of slave to society because
oh, sure.
their lives aren't their own. You know, they get raised and then just sent to the slaughter, and, like, you know, they're not considered people, so...
Right, they have no choice.
Yeah, I mean, they just gotta do...
I was thinking of, there's a Heinlein novel called Friday, and the protagonist is a, you know, genetically engineered being, and there are some places when you go in, like, your ID will say, like, L.A. in the corner, which stands for Living Artifact, so if, like, a cop pulls you over, they know you're not actually a person.
Oh.
I'm wondering if there's some of the stuff like, I wonder if there's stuff like that going on in this world, because they
yeah.
can, like, drive around and
mm-hmm.
I guess they probably don't, like, go rent a flat in the middle of everybody else and live in the city.
Well, I don't think they get jobs, aside from, like, being carers.
Right.
So, but yeah, like, you know, you can go out to eat and go on vacation and, like, go into stores and stuff, and people are perfectly friendly to you as long as they don't know you're a clone.
Yeah, presumably if you told them, they'd get the willies.
But...
because even these clone-friendly, so to speak, people were kind of weirded out. Like, ah, don't touch me.
Yeah, but it's weird, because it's like, well, you couldn't tell I was a clone before I told you I was a clone, so...
Right.
Like, what the fuck are
they? Well, exactly. And so this kind of is rolling over nicely into something else, into something we wanted to talk about, which is we were wondering if some of this was trying to illustrate just discrimination in general, and how certainly through history there have been many minority groups who have been considered to be less than people by the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least lesser people. And
we can treat you like this because you're not real people.
Right, like, don't touch me, you dirty gypsy, it's weird. And, well, you wouldn't... like, you wouldn't even know they're part of that group.
Yeah.
If they weren't going out of their way to advertise it.
Yeah, yeah. Or, I mean, obviously slaves is a...
or slavery in America, it's almost impossible to avoid that if you're talking about discrimination.
Right, like the whole slave owner perception of like, well, that's a slave's place, is to be a slave.
Right,
they're
yeah.
They're not real people, so it doesn't really matter.
Or maybe kind of like the revulsion to being touched is maybe more comparable to how some people felt about gay people a couple decades ago.
Yeah, don't touch me, you'll give me AIDS.
Right, yeah, just that... it's like, what if they're carrying some disease, or what if they put some sort of gay skin oil on me and I become gay? I don't know what that was
right.
about.
Right, but then you, like, would never know someone was gay if they didn't tell exactly. you they were gay.
Don't get your weird... don't hit me with your weird clone microwave rays. I don't... want to be a clone. I don't think you understand how this works.
I will say, I have looked at people before and known they were gay, but it's usually if they're like a drag queen or something. I will say, it's not true across the board, but you usually have to be advertising it pretty hard.
Right.
Like in a gay pride parade or something, it's like, okay, well, I guess I can assume you're gay because you have a sign that says gay, I'm proud. But, but yeah, like, if the cloning is a commentary. And I would definitely say that when you read the book, you are not supposed to close it going, okay, now I'm going to sit down and decide if this method of cloning was good or bad.
Right.
Like, I think when you end it, you're supposed to be kind of horrified by, like, what's happening to these people.
Yeah, the obvious issue is not a question of bioethics. It's a statement on bioethics, right? It's, okay, this is what's happening in this book. It's not supposed to be pictured as something we'd have a real debate about.
Yeah.
Which is maybe a weakness, maybe not, because I agree that the purpose of the book is not to have a debate about whether we should clone people for spare parts.
Yeah, I think most people would agree that's not a good thing.
It would be difficult to find a person who thinks it's a good idea.
Especially because so many people seem to be opposed to just cloning in general.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is because they're afraid weird crap like that's going to start happening.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of, without any rules, regulation, or ethics whatsoever, there are a lot of doors that could be opened. It's one of the things I wonder about this world is what are the circumstances where the minority opposition to this isn't saying, oh my god, we're horrible, but is rather saying, well, maybe we should put them in nice schools until they're old enough to harvest their organs.
Yeah, keep them sheltered and give them a good childhood so they're cultured.
Right.
What?
Huh? So they're cultured dead men walking.
Yeah, Ben and I thought that was kind of interesting that there didn't seem to be a character in the book that was really vocally, or like a movement that was really vocally opposed. The only character we have, Miss Lucy, who's one of the guardians at the school for a short amount of time, and she actually does seem to be horrified by what's happening to these kids and really torn by it. And she keeps saying inappropriate things like, you know what's going to happen to you in the future, because she thinks like they're being too sheltered, which is one of the things Hailsham is doing, is
right.
is shielding them from their fate so they can live happy childhoods.
Yes.
For their own good, kind of thing. And Miss Lucy is just like, no, that's not right. We have to tell them what's going on. And she seems to get really upset when she thinks about it. But she's essentially powerless and gets fired from the school for saying one thing too many. And she's pretty much the only one.
Yeah, I mean, that is another one of the things that we were wondering about a little bit, is what level of protectiveness is not okay versus is maybe a little okay.
Yeah, so, like, is it okay not to tell someone something to protect them? Or should you always tell them? Or how much should you tell them?
There are definitely things that we don't tell children, or that we even make taboo to children. You know, a lot of kids get to right around their teenage years thinking that saying the word fuck is like an act of rebellion.
Yeah.
Like the worst thing ever. And I'm not quite sure why we do that, because I don't know anybody who doesn't say it occasionally.
That's true. Like, I don't know any, like, all adults are like, oh, I'm having a kid, I guess I gotta stop swearing for a while.
Like, well, why?
But then everyone's like, yeah, like, when my kid hits 14, I'm totally gonna start cussing again. So it's like, okay, so, like, if you're between 0 and 12, cussing's bad, and then once you hit, like, 13, like, it's cool again.
Right.
It's kind of a weird standard.
If you're under the age of 13, then saying fuck will stunt your development. Like, what's the bad scenario? Is, like, the school gonna call you occasionally? Yeah, your first grader just said fuck. Well, yeah, it's a word, so conversation okay. Over, right? Like, they're not in trouble anymore at that point.
Your kid just said, I gotta go take a shit. Well, did they have to go take a shit? Like, whatever.
What do you want to do? Shit in the middle of your classroom?
I raised civilized children.
That's right. Just maybe a better comparison would be just the harsh realities.
Yeah.
Part of
everyone gets a certain age where they're like, oh, fuck, that happens?
Right.
Or, like, my parents, like, a real person? That sucks.
Right.
I thought they were just, like, a perfect scion of God or something. Until you hit a certain age. Yeah, kind of the same thing of, like, well, we kind of know we're clones and what's going to happen to us. We don't really talk about it. And then when you finally, like, hit a certain age, it's like, okay, going for your first donation. And you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Oh, bother.
And then one of the things they touched on as well was the issue of sex.
Yeah.
None of the clones are able to reproduce, which...
Yeah, they're genetically modified, I guess, so they can't reproduce.
If you can clone people, you might as well genetically modify the clones to not be a breeding population.
Yeah.
You can see where that would cause problems.
Yeah, having a family would probably complicate the tearing you away from your family and harvesting you for organs.
Well, it's part of that clone experience, too. They don't have parents. They're not related to someone in that way, so most of society will never miss them. And the parts of society that might are going to suffer the same fate within a couple of years at the outside.
You're right.
But they were, the teachers were telling them, well, hey, sex is, they were trying to be sex positive, right?
Yeah,
they totally were. As we would now say. And
sex is an expression of love.
Right.
Like, it's okay to do it. I think Miss Emily's take was, like, it's totally fine to do it. It's an expression of your feelings. But just make sure, like, if you like the person, then you'll like sex better. Kind of thing, like, encouraging them not to just, like, go around and have sex willy-nilly, but, like... guide them a little bit to form little relationships.
Right, yeah. And at the same time, like, kind of through their reactions to... the guardians' reactions to sex, proving that they're not quite as comfortable with it as they're trying to tell the students to be. Which I think is a little bit how we actually are in society, actually.
Yeah.
Because we're always... Each generation seems to try to find its way to deal with the subject in a way that won't fuck it up for their kids. And it's... no one's found, like, a comfortable way to do it yet, because the kids are always comfortable with just a little bit more than the parents are, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, where you're like, no, sex is totally fine. But then if you, like, actually walk in on them having sex, you're like, oh, God, stop it!
What are you doing?
Like, you told me sex was okay. Get out of here.
Come on, kid. Well, yeah.
Yeah, we talked about everything.
Nicely done.
Very nicely done. Yes. Okay. Any plot points we want to discuss that we haven't gotten around to? One thing we haven't really touched on that we didn't talk a ton about in the outline that was kind of an interesting part of the book was Kathy's tape. And that the song, Never Let Me Go.
Right, where the title comes from.
That she just loved. And, you know, her whole child imagination, she turned it into a song about a woman singing about her baby that got taken away. But it's, like, one of those, you know...
Of course.
Breakup songs or whatever.
Yeah, of course it's not. It's one of those...
She even knows it's not.
Right, it's like, oh, baby, baby. One of those
sort
of
things. Yeah, Never Let Me Go. Yeah. Oh, baby. And, like, just how deeply connected to it, and, like, the kind of two points I thought it centered on was when her tape got lost, and then Tommy, like, was like, let's find your tape, when they took the trip to Norfolk, and they found it, and she and Tommy just had a couple hours together where it seemed like, oh, they're gonna get together, or whatever, and then when Ruth discovered weeks later that they, like, went and got the tape and, like, never told her, then she kind of exacts her revenge upon them.
Yes.
You know, telling Kathy, well, Tommy's not into girls who have had sex with other guys and stuff like that. And then Madam catching Kathy listening to the song and, like, dancing around and pretending to hold her baby and...
Well, and having her own version in her mind of what it was, too, for that matter.
Right, because Kathy thinks, like, oh, she must be sad because, like, we can't have babies, and I was pretending to hold a baby, and Madam's was more like on a, Kathy is, like, a general stand-in for all clones, like, trying to cling to this world and say, never let me go, but the world is, like, harvesting them for organs and killing them. So I guess that song is in and of itself kind of can be a symbol. But yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting the way like that one song and that tape kind of got enmeshed in the plot of the book.
Yeah, so something that was a little difficult to determine for this book was what exactly the theme might be.
Harvesting people for organs is bad.
Yeah, right. Because we've touched on a couple of these issues, and rather than being moments, a lot of them are kind of threads through the book, and you could kind of wonder. I mean, you could ask the question, is this book just an extended metaphor on discrimination?
Yeah.
Is it about friendship?
Yeah, but it doesn't really seem to be.
I don't get that friendship thematic vibe, at least, just because usually if that's your theme, it leads somewhere.
Yeah, and like Ben and I were saying, it's not really like a doomed love story.
Is it your classic man's inhumanity to man sort of thing? Like, I was wondering if there was an existential, like, horror element to this of, well, you know, ultimately it's all meaningless because we're all going to be harvested for our organs.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, like, the reason the story's a tragedy at heart.
Yeah, it's very sad, but it's very sad in undertones. It's what you're talking about earlier, like, but subdued.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, look at all these, like, this potential that these kids, you know, like, so Kathy and Tommy have the potential to, like, be together forever and, like, have a family, if that was possible, and, like, Ruth kind of harbors these dreams, one of her only sympathetic moments, harbors these dreams of, like, working in an office and, like, getting to share and explore ideas and, like, contribute to society and how these, they kind of, like, harbor these dreams and hopes, and some of them are really smart or well-read or well-written or whatever, and they could just be, you know, these up-and-coming students from this, like, private school.
Right.
And, like...
Well, she mentioned when they're at the cottages, they're... A lot of their discussions would be about, you know, fine points of philosophy or literature or something like that.
This is, like, wasted wasted potential, or like...
I could definitely see there being a human potential theme to this with, you know, a downer ending, but still illustrates the point.
Mm-hmm. Like, these people are real, and they do have souls, and they have complicated relationships, and then this is happening to them.
Maybe the theme is just trying to define what a person is.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a... Maybe I'm partially thinking about that because I know you just finished this, but The Amber Spyglass, which I am currently reading, not to skip ahead, but there's that moment when Mary Malone meets the Mulefa, and like the second she realizes they're communicating, despite the fact they look all weird just in her brain, oh, these are people, not creatures.
Yeah. They're not animals, they're people.
Right. So if you think that about them, what's so hard about accepting a cloned human?
I think Philip Pullman would probably accept clone dudes.
I think he'd probably be okay, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the themes I said is this can't actually be a coming-of-age story because you can't actually come of age and then go out and, you know, succeed based on getting past your shit.
I guess it could be a coming-of-age story also with a downer ending.
Yeah.
They spend all these years and they... finally figure out who they are and what their reality is, and because of what their reality is, that means they have no future. Woof, dark.
Come on, guy.
Kazuo. What are you doing?
So, I said that I think there is a symbol in this book, Madame's Gallery, which Tommy theorizes is they use your artwork so that when you show up with your significant other for a deferral, so you get, you know, a couple extra years to be together instead of getting harvested. They use all the artwork in the gallery to, like, look at your true soul and see if you're really meant for each other. And if you're really in love, then yeah, you can get, like, 5 years off. And the point of it really is to do with their souls, but not in terms of deferrals, but just in terms of trying to prove to society at large that clones have souls.
Yeah.
So I think her gallery as a whole is kind of a symbol for clone souls.
Yeah, and...
And hope and and a change in society. Yeah. And it doesn't seem like that's actually going to happen, but...
One of the things that reminds me of is there was another rumor going around that sometimes when you... complete, which is their euphemism for dying after donations, on like your third, fourth donation, a late donation, that they actually, like, it sounds like, would hook you up to machines and keep you alive long enough to harvest you piecemeal, keeping you this weird semi-conscious nightmare for a few more weeks or something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, that was just a rumor, and I was going, that's kind of... interesting. Rumors in this book have a way of being like, you know, rumors. They're never true in their entirety, but a lot of times they're hinting at something that's out there. And with that sort of thing specifically, I certainly wouldn't put it past these people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's better to die in an early donation because then you die.
Well, it makes me wonder, like, presumably when you don't make it past a donation, they then go ahead and harvest all the stuff that you needed to keep staying, to still walk around and breathe.
Yeah.
Because I doubt they're going to the trouble of having all these clones without taking any donor hearts somewhere along the line.
Right.
Or maybe a fourth donation, maybe by the time you get to fourth donation, that's what it is. It's like, well, we've harvested all this stuff, you can survive getting taken from you.
So now we need, like, your lungs and your heart and whatever else. Yeah. Yeah, it was never entirely clear, but Ben and I were speculating on that. Because we're like, okay, Tommy finished his third donation, he's still walking around, like, how much did they take from him each time? And what did they take from him? Because he's donated organs 3 times and he's still alive.
Right. He's got to be down several organs that you can at least live for a couple years without. And it's like almost imagining him with like a peg leg and a hook hand and an eye patch.
Yeah, like, yeah, we need your skin for whatever.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Like, what's going on?
has a big raw patch on my back because someone needed a skin graft.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess another point of interest that we just haven't really talked about is possibles, which are people that maybe you were cloned from. So your possible would be possibly the person you were cloned from.
Yes.
And there's a big plot point where they think maybe they found Ruth's possible in Norfolk and they all go out there to check it out. And then Ruth kind of has this moment of like, oh, like, if you need to find possibles, you gotta go, like, check out the drug addicts and the prostitutes and, like, the dregs of society, because they've never actually cloned someone who was wealthy or powerful or successful.
Right. Well, that's one thing that Kathy was worried about, too, because she was had a habit for a little while of flipping through porn magazines looking for a face like hers, essentially. Yeah. You know, because are you gonna clone the president and harvest that for parts?
Yeah.
Well, nah, why don't you just take some homeless people, some criminals and streetwalkers and people that the rest of us mostly look down on, and no one would miss them, so who's gonna miss their clones?
Yeah. Right, like, and that's another way you could argue, maybe, that clones don't really matter, because it's like, well, there's clone from a prostitute, whatever.
Sure, well, I'm sure if you got to see this larger society, you would see plenty of rationalizations along those lines.
Right, where if you clone, like Ben said, if you clone to the president would be like, you're not going to cut up my clone? Fuck that! kind of thing.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Strengths of the writing.
Alright. Well, we both thought that it was a pretty compelling book, even though it really nothing actually happens.
Yeah, like, in the traditional sense, there's not really a lot of plot.
They go places and have conversations. They don't go places and do things.
And like we said, you know, a lot of the big moments are very quiet and understated. Yes. So there's not a lot of, like, shouting matches and people freaking out and doing stuff like that. But yeah, even though it was just like, oh, let me tell you about some of these weird things that happened to me when I was a student at Hailsham, I was still interested in it, so.
And I thought a lot of the relationship-y stuff, a lot of the character stuff, felt like real people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe not all really common stuff, but stuff that seems believable or is related to experiences a lot of us have had, especially the stuff with the kids. Like, the children really seemed like children, not like some adult's concept of what childhood is like, even though
yeah.
they've totally forgotten what childhood is like.
Right.
And as far as weaknesses go, we already talked about it, we both had some pretty major issues with Kathy and Ruth's friendship, because
yeah.
it's one of those friendships where Kathy keeps saying, we're best friends. No, really, we used to have a heart-to-heart talk every evening, but you don't get to see a single one of those.
Well, you get to see one where they fight.
Well, yeah, that's true. They're always having some level of tension and conflict.
Yeah. And then at the end, you kind of discover, like, well, were they really that good of friends, like, all along? Because Ruth seems to have been, like, fairly resentful of Kathy and, like, lying to her.
Right.
And stuff like that. So, yeah, we had a hard time, like, believing that they could be friends when Ruth was not that great. And to Kathy, like, why would Kathy even bother with her?
And, I don't know if I had any other major complaints.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wanted to know more about how society worked in the cloning and stuff, but I don't know if that, since that wasn't, like, the purpose of the book, I can't really say it was, like, a weakness. It was just kind of
yeah.
something I wanted more of.
Well, yeah, the questions, it's basically a list of things about how this society works and what their politics are like and what their rationales and ethics are like.
Because in a typical novel that did something like this, you would expect it to open up and be like, here's how society works.
Yeah, and to illustrate it pretty graphically early on and then get into the story and then bring bits of it back in periodically, right?
Yeah, and then at the end of the clones, like, try to run away or something.
Or even if you opened it more subtly, you would expect, like, students to see protesters at the gates of the school on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Being chased off by police or security forces.
Yeah.
And, like, having conflict related to that. Oh, well, it feels like we're imprisoned in here, because we kind of sort of are. And we don't like it when the protesters come, because they make us feel less like people, ironically, because they're trying to say we are people, but...
Right. Yeah, but none of that's really...
Yeah. None of that shit is there.
It's not that kind of book.
And also kind of the medicine. Like, I assume it's fucking awesome if they're able... if society at large accepts this. I was going, so... by having a ready stock of clone parts at all times, do people just live healthy 200-year-long lives now?
Right, like, all cancer is cured. There's, like, no degenerative diseases anymore. They can just cure everything.
Right. We just swap parts out, man.
Yeah. Well, and that also made me wonder, because typically if you get, like, an organ donation in, like, today's world, so, you know, like, you get a new, not spleen, but you get, like, a new liver or whatever, you still have to be on, like, the cocktail of drugs for the rest of your life, because otherwise your body's going to reject that liver, even if it's, like, a perfect match.
Right.
Or a new heart or whatever. And Saeed was telling us, like, sometimes people who are, like, poor, they'll get, like, a heart replacement, but they can't afford the medication, so they just won't take it. And then, like, you know, 5 years later, they need a new heart again because their body's rejecting their new heart.
Yeah.
And so my question was, like, is this form of medicine, did they figure out a way to, like, have these bodies accept new organs, or is, like, everyone in society just on, like, a giant cocktail of drugs at all times?
Maybe that's, I mean, that makes you wonder about the one-to-one part of it, but I guess maybe most people are healthy most of the time, so they probably don't do that.
Right, like, you don't need one clone for every person.
Yeah, like, I'd almost rather just keep one in a vat somewhere of me. Maybe we'll grow him without a brain so he doesn't know he's me.
Okay. But what if you need a brain replacement?
Well, then maybe that's the one thing our medical science can't quite take care of. It's alright, it's all going to be digital by then. We're going to get rid of this big bulbous brain that rattles off the interior of the skull and causes concussions. We're just going to put a well-padded hard drive the size of my thumbnail in the middle of there. And I'll be able to remember more stuff that way.
Yeah. We'll all be robots.
That's right. Ah! In the distant future, the year 2000.
That would be the new... question with hard drive brains, are we still people?
That's right. Once we cross the singularity...
What's your verdict?
I am very... Gaps. I'm very curious about the world they live in. As I guess I just demonstrated with my passel of questions. But I thought it was effective if the idea was to show me these interactions between characters and to... pique my interest in various aspects of the book. It worked. Assuming that one of the goals was also for me to feel sad at the end, then that worked too. I thought it was it's a really good discussion book. I see why it's a book club type of recommendation.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was a compelling read for sure. Even though it is, like, a very low-key book where not a lot of stuff happens, so I thought it was definitely a point in its favor. I would say if you're a typical science fiction reader, you don't want to necessarily just read this because it's science fiction, though. It is just a lot more, like, characters, relationships type book and not, like, a clones book.
Right.
Which is one of the reasons why I don't think, like, the fact that they're clones is that huge of a spoiler.
Yeah, I was trying to get that across to someone I was talking to earlier in the week. I was saying, yeah, it's kind of this, I guess it's kind of a science fiction-y premise, because I knew this guy was a science fiction guy, and I was doing, but don't necessarily pick it up just based on that premise. Like, also, like, be okay with reading about a bunch of low-key relationship stuff and never getting to learn details about that premise.
Yeah.
If you're gonna read it, but it is food for thought. The people I have been talking to about this book giving a brief sketch of what it is, have been intrigued, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. Just about everyone has gone, oh, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I was debating whether or not to tell people, and when I was reading it, because I knew it was about clones, and so when I was reading it, I was kind of trying to say, like, see where the little bits were that are kind of hinting at that, until they, like, kind of straight up say it at one point. And I was thinking, okay, if you went into this book, like, not knowing anything about it, would the clone revelation be, like, a big, like, oh, shit! Or, like, is that really not that important?
It seems to be part of this little summary that accompanies it everywhere. If you're going to give the elevator pitch for this book, because I've been struggling with that, too. They're like, oh, what's that about? Because, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, it's about a guy who's a wizard and he's fighting werewolves. It's like, that's pretty, it's pretty simple, yeah. In this, with this one, it's more of a, well, it's about students who, clones and organs and, sad.
Okay.
So read it. And they go, well, that sounds intriguing. I'm like, oh, okay, well, it must. So I already admitted that I'm reading The Amber Spyglass by Philip Pullman. What are you reading?
I just finished yesterday night. Dreams of Gods and Monsters by Lonnie Taylor. It's the third book in a trilogy, like much like The Amber Spyglass. Well, I guess I don't want to talk about it, really, because it's the third book in a trilogy, so...
You don't want to give too many details.
There's a lot of stuff going on. I will say that there was, like, in the last... Because I was reading on a Kindle, and so I had, like... I was, like, 85% of the way through the book, and then all of a sudden these new characters show up and are like, here's this huge new plot point! And then the book ended with them preparing to face the plot point, but the book ended with the end, so it was the last book, and I was like, what the fuck? Like, is she planning on writing, like, a second trilogy of books? Because...
Maybe it's one of those four-book trilogies.
But then why would she write the end at?
I don't know.
If it wasn't the last... That, it really baffled me, because I was like, oh yeah, everything's tied up, this is great. Why are you doing this?
I'm assuming it sold well and someone handed her a check.
Well, and it was kind of one of those things where, like, a couple of those things were kind of hinted at in books 1 and 2, but they never went anywhere.
I see.
So I wasn't convinced, like, it was ever going to become a thing, but then it ended up being a huge thing.
Maybe it's a authorial choice. I don't know. There are probably authors who do this and they plant little hooks of things they think are kind of intriguing, and if they have time to get to them, they can, and if they don't, they won't, and then if later down the line you sell well and someone says, hey, yeah, here's the deal. I know that was a trilogy, but we'd really like to pay you to write a fourth and fifth book in this series. You can go, well, I guess there are those hooks I planted back in the book. And now it won't look like I'm making it up at the last second to extend the series.
Yeah.
Because definitely long-running, I mean, when you go past a trilogy, long-running series tend to suffer from that at some point.
We had the Aspel.
Yeah, well, I was thinking Honor Harrington, since I read a ton of those. Like, it got through what was clearly the plot. And then they're like, oh, and now there's going to be a war with these guys, too. And they're even bigger and scarier. And you're like, okay, I love this universe and characters enough that I'm probably going to read it, but I know it's bullshit the whole time I'm reading it.
I always wonder why it is that, like, once you finish the first plot, in order to, like, pull the second plot out, you have to, like, make it even bigger and crazier. They're like, oh, we just defeated these bad guys that took us 5 books to defeat, and we weren't sure we were gonna do it, and it almost killed all of us, and now these second bad guys are, like, 12 times worse.
Yeah, I've always kind of wanted to write something that subverts an epic trope. I mean, not in the way of little things along the way, but in the way of, like, completely turning something on its head, like having one of those plucky rebels are fighting the big bad authoritarian government, and at the end of the third trilogy, they get crushed because they're just way weaker.
The end. Goodbye.
The end by pissing off every fan. Or writing the, like, seven-book arc of this epic war and sequence of political events, and you get to the end of it, and the publisher's like, we want another book. And so you just write this totally mundane YA story taking place in peacetime after all of those events.
Yeah, it's like the daughter of one of the dead characters, like, falling in love with someone, right. But, like, it's not like she fell in love with the son of his enemy. It's just, like, some guy, and it's fine, and, like...
Or set up an A-plot where, like, some warlord had actually survived, and he comes back, and he's gathering his forces, and then he gets crushed because they're, like, 5% as strong as they were a year ago. And that's not actually the A-plot, and there's actually just, like, all of this dated, like, slice-of-life stuff happening after that.
That would be pretty funny.
So, anyway, if any of you have thoughts, suggestions, questions, you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can email us, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
We're on Twitter, @novelideaspod.
And you can find us on iTunes.
Yes, and if you do that, then, you know, like, write stuff.
Yeah.
So, next week, we are going to be doing And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie. Another reader suggestion, actually.
Yes.
Also, I've never read any Agatha Christie, so...
Me neither.
Long, long overdue.
Yeah, it seemed like an oversight on our parts.
And I think that is going to do it.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see you next time.
Bye.